Hello and welcome to Travels Through Time, the podcast made in partnership with Jordan Lloyd and Colourgraph. I'm Peter Moore. Today we're setting off on a tour of some of the great cities of the ancient world, and we're being taken there by Professor Greg Wolfe. When we think of the ancient world, we often think of its great cities of Athens, Sparta, Rome, Carthage, Alexandria. It's a glittering list of places that were centres of power, culture, and conflict. But what were those cities really like, and how do we know what we do know about them? These are the questions that we're putting to today's guest. Professor Greg Wolfe is a hugely distinguished scholar of the ancient world. His academic career began with a degree in ancient and modern history at Oxford in the 80s, and he's now director of the Institute of Classical Studies at the University of London. Known for his work on Roman imperialism, Wolfe's latest book is called The Life and Death of Ancient Cities. So who better to take my colleague Violet Moller on a picaresque tour of some of the greatest cities of them all at a crucial moment in time?
Welcome to Travels Through Time, Greg Wolfe. Thank you very much for coming on. I'd like to start off by just talking a bit about how you got the idea for your book, Ancient Cities. Is it something you've been thinking about for a long time, or did you just feel there was a gap in the market for something like this?
Yes, the book is something I've been thinking about for a long time. One of my first jobs was to teach ancient history in Oxford, and at the same time Barry Cunliffe was starting a new degree on archaeology and anthropology. And one of the big themes he wanted to do was cities. And so I began to read a bit outside my comfort zone and just really got hooked. So in a way, it's Barry I have to thank for getting involved in cities on the grand scale. And I've kept in the background for a while, so it was lovely to have the opportunity to write this book.
Well, I very much enjoyed reading it. And I wondered if you could talk a bit about the geographical scope of it and how you decided which parts of the world you were going to include.
Yeah, the book's got sort of two parts. I mean, the frame of it, the big story, is the story of the last 6,000 years or so. 6,000 years ago, nobody lived in cities. Now, the vast majority of us do. Probably by the end of this century, three quarters of the people in the world will live in big cities. In some places like the UK, about 95% live in cities already. So my first approach was, you know, why have cities arisen? Why then? And why did they spread around the world? Why did they appear in so many different places simultaneously? Because it's not one invention that spreads. And then that sort of took me back to looking at my original terrain, that of the sort of ancient Mediterranean world, which classicists study, Greece, Rome, Etruscans, Phoenicians, and people who came into contact with them around, Egyptians, and Spaniards, Gauls, Africans, and so on. And I realized that the cities of the ancient world, the ancient Mediterranean world, were actually really tiny, and they had compared to those of other civilizations, and they appeared really quite late. And so I thought, well, at school we're always taught that Greece and Rome are great urban civilizations. We look at pictures of the Acropolis and the Roman Forum and Constantinople and all these great places. And yet in the ancient world, they were mostly really quite small. So that was the lead in, really.
Yes, I thought it was very interesting how, you know, you go right back in history and actually, you know, there's centuries and centuries, thousands of years before the kind of our idea of where the ancient world sort of starts. I thought that was a very interesting, it was interesting to have that sort of extra scope.
It's fascinating, right, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, we're all becoming global historians in one way or another. And I mean, your book traces developments across a whole series of cities geographically dispersed. And I guess 30 or 40 years ago, people would have told everyone to narrow down and specialise and become the world expert on Madrid in the 16th century or something like that, and now we're all looking for these wider horizons.
Yeah, I think it is exciting. It's a good it's good to be able to sort of take a step back, as it were, and look at things from a broader geographical perspective and also chronological, And I thought that was very interesting. I wonder how, so, you know, when we think about a city today, there's certain criteria. I think there's actually, it has to have a cathedral, doesn't it, today, in order to qualify as a city.
I suspect that's the sort of British one, isn't it? Yes.
But I wonder, in the ancient world, what do you think the sort of criteria were? Because as you say, they were much smaller, but they were still thought of as cities. Can you talk a bit about that?
Their criteria are different to ours, of course. And we often talk about ancient Athens, but if you read Herodotus, Thucydides, they talk about the Athenians and the Corinthians and the Spartans, and they often talk about the people, not the city. So for them, often they think about a population as having the same gods, living in the same landscape, the same myths, the same language. Athenians believed that no one had ever lived in their land before, that they were the first inhabitants, that they were autochthonous, that they were all interrelated, the kinship's important for them. And even people who knew they had come from a long way away, like the inhabitants of colonies around the Mediterranean, they still had a sense of a common history, a common origin, a common place. So in that sense, I think sort of the community was often thought about in ways that didn't push the physical city into the front of the frame. But as for a city itself, I mean, sometimes, you know, like all states, they often used administrative divisions. You know, do you make your own coinage? Are you responsible for, in the Roman Empire, a city is something that is responsible for collecting its own taxes?
That's so it's sort of a political, it has a political
yes.
function.
Yes, exactly. Yes, it's and of course, politics is different when you're being given a function from above, like almost like sort of municipal government today, or when it's about being completely autonomous. That's another Greek touch word for a city, that they're people who make their own laws and live by their own laws, their own nomoi.
Yes.
So, yes. So politics, descent, kinship, place.
So if we just talk for a little bit, I know we're going to get to our year soon, but if we just talk a little bit about the earlier ancient history, how big, for example, in, I don't know, the 4th century BC, how big would cities have been roughly, or is it very difficult to tell?
It's difficult to tell precisely, but the big picture is pretty clear now, that most cities had just a few thousand, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 people in them. Which is about the size of the Scottish fishing village I live in at the moment, actually.
That's an amazing thought, isn't it?
It is, it's extraordinary. And then there's these tiny number, the ones we've heard of course, Corinth, Sparta and Athens. And they have maybe 40, 50,000 people in them at most, but often a bit less than that, sort of 10, 20,000. And it's not always easy to tell who's living in the city centre and who's in the countryside, but it's that order of things.
And would there have been a lot of interchange between the people in the surrounding villages coming in and selling, you know, the crops that they'd grown and that kind of thing? Were these cities very connected with their hinterland?
I think they were. I mean, when we get to 4th century Athens, people do begin to characterise people who only live in the countryside as being agroika, being sort of like yokels, not quite peasants, but something like that. So the beginning of a city-town divide. But if you think of a city of 2,000, yeah, probably most of that population have their own plots of land around. And if you even Roman Pompeii, which is a relatively big city, inside the city there are gardens, productive gardens, there's vineyards, people are growing crops in the city and around it. And yes, it's a market for people living within 1 or 2 days' walk. Just right. A few hours' walk in some cases.
So now I think let's go to your year that you've chosen, which is 146 and 145 BC, or BCE, as it's now called. And we do allow quite a lot of latitude when it comes to ancient history. We're not strict about there being just one particular year, because
that's very kind.
It's difficult, isn't it, when you're in the ancient world, things aren't so precise. And you have you're going to take us to three different cities, and I think that the first one is Carthage. But before we arrive there, perhaps you'd like to just give us a little bit of general background about what is going on in the year 146.
Yes, I'd be glad to. 146 is it's a watershed moment. It's a key point at which the city of Rome becomes effectively the ruling power of the whole Mediterranean world. And to give a bit of context on that, nearly 200 years before, when Alexander the Great died, he had conquered a huge empire that extended from the Balkans to the Hindu Kush, to Afghanistan, Egypt, Persia, and so on. And that empire came apart after his death. It was divided into a series of huge kingdoms, Macedon, Egypt, Syria. And over to the west, on the other side of the Adriatic Sea, it was all quite tiny city-states, people who'd hardly been heard of by the Greek writers, who are only historians for that period. So that's 323 BC. And now, nearly 200 years later, Rome has got to the point where those great kingdoms have almost all been knocked down. Macedon's been humbled, Syria's been humbled, and Rome dominates Italy and also has footholds in Africa and Spain and so on. And it's a key moment where Rome power is tested, and it fights two great wars in these years, one against its old rival Carthage, which is more or less on the site of modern Tunis, and the other is a war in southern Greece, which it sort of got into accidentally. And in this 1 year, 146, two of the largest cities of the ancient world, Corinth and Carthage, are taken by Romans and sacked and destroyed. And this set off ripples of anxiety, of course, around the Mediterranean world. But we're particularly lucky because we have an account of this from somebody who was there on both occasions, a Greek writer, a man named Polybius. In some ways, one of the first global historians, going back to our theme earlier, who tried to write a history of the entire world, a universal history, showing how in just 50 years or so, it had gone from being completely disunited, lots of separate strands of histories, to being united under Roman rule. So 145, 146, these are the moments at which that seemed to Polybius and to the Romans and probably most other people who knew about history. History turned a corner. It was a moment, yes.
So Polybius was Greek. Whereabouts did he come from? I mean, how far can we trust his account? What were his biases?
He's very well informed. He is a Greek aristocrat. He was actually a politician who was one of 1,000 Greek politicians who were interned as being anti-Roman and then taken to Rome and kept as hostages in 167. So by the time he's writing, he's been a Roman captive for 20 years. But as often happened with these high-ranking Greek captives, they're valued by the captors and become honoured guests. And so he knows lots of the great leading figures. He knows the ferocious elder Cato, who's a great moralist. He knows the general Scipio. He's somebody people go to for advice on the Greek world. And he tries to act as a mediator. He tries to avoid conflict unsuccessfully. So he knows a huge amount. And while he sort of weeps for Greece and what's happened to it, there's a sense in which he's pretty clearly absorbed a lot of Roman ideas. And you know, it's almost Stockholm syndrome, perhaps. He identifies with his captors.
But also that's part of the trend which really gathered pace later on, of the Romans helping themselves to Greek culture and taking it on as their own, isn't it?
Absolutely, yes, exactly that, yes. I mean, Cato, one of Polybius's acquaintances, he claimed he hated Greeks and complained about them. But if you look at what Cato himself wrote, it's clear he read vast amounts of Greek literature and in some ways was trying to rival Greeks rather than despise them. So yeah, very much part of a general phenomenon.
Let's go to Carthage. If you could tell us what's happening. Was Polybius actually there? Was he an eyewitness?
He was there. He was there at the last moments, yes. But Carthage had fought three great wars against Rome, one in the 3rd century and then the one that we associate with Hannibal, that ended with Hannibal being defeated in 2002. And after that, Carthage is... No, it's it's clearly been sort of humbled by Rome, and it's lost its first empire in Sicily and lost its possessions in Sardinia and Spain. And it's really just, it's still an enormous city, and it's still very wealthy, agriculturally wealthy. It's dependent on Rome, and Rome has imposed really punishing conditions on it over the last two generations since the defeat of Hannibal. Rome is still distrustful. I mean, Cato used to finish every one of his speeches saying, "Carthago delenda est." It's my opinion, Carthage must be obliterated, it must be destroyed. And then eventually, on a pretext, the Carthaginians rearm themselves. They're not supposed to have weapons. And they rearm themselves not to fight the Romans, but to fight some of their African neighbours. Rome takes this as a pretext, comes in. Carthage is given terms. It's all in 150. Carthage is told that if they want to survive, they have to abandon their city and go and live in a new place at least 10 miles from the sea. It's a request that they can't comply with. They were descended from Phoenicians. They had traded all over. They explored beyond the Phoenicians, explored beyond the Straits of Gibraltar in 1000 BC. I mean, there's a huge long back history of Phoenicians in the West that seems to get longer and longer the more we look at it. And so the Carthaginians, they can't agree to this request. They can't agree to become a isolated land power separated from their roots and their ways of life. And so they defy the Romans, and the Romans come in, and there's a siege. Takes a while. They're besieged in 147. In 146, the city falls. Hasdrubal surrenders. The dramatic scenes. And Polybius describes this scene where the Roman general Scipio Aemilianus, the great, the last of the great Scipios dynasty, has been fighting for Rome for generations. And Scipio is weeping to see Carthage burning, and Polybius says, why do you weep? Why are you so upset? And he says, I'm weeping because one day this will happen to my civilization as well. It happened to Troy, it happened to the kingdoms of Assyria and the Macedonians, the Persians. And there's this sort of sense of a cycle of empires, that people reach their end point. So that's the very contemporary consciousness. Polybius records as an eyewitness of Scipio quoting Homer on the fall of Troy. And so this is a Roman general quoting Homer in Greek to a Greek captive and saying, just like Troy fell, and don't forget, Rome's in some sense think themselves descendants of Trojans, just like Troy fell once and as Carthage falls, now one day this will happen to Rome as well.
Goodness me.
Quite a poignant moment.
Very poignant, yeah, very sad. Why do you think that they burnt the city? Was that just something that happened during the chaos of the battle? Did they never want to keep, you know, try and preserve the city and then take it over and the inhabitants into slavery?
Well, they did enslave them, and they took as much wealth as they could, but which is what Romans always did when they sacked a city. They did Syracuse and lots of other cities. But yeah, they regretted it almost immediately, Violet. And within just a few years, you have one of the sort of popular politicians is proposing they create a new Roman colony there named after Juno, which is the Roman name for Tanit, the great goddess of the Carthaginians. And they want to create a city called Junonia. That doesn't get anywhere, but almost 100 years exactly after the fall of Carthage, Julius Caesar creates a new colony, and it grows enormously because it's still got all the things that made original Carthage great, fantastic, you know, rich fields behind it, wonderful harbour. And Roman Carthage is one of the greatest cities of late antiquity. St. Augustine taught there, had amazing monuments. So, they did regret it.
What did they burn down? What would have been there? Do we have any idea what the city would have looked like? What was it built of? If we'd embarked off a trireme into the harbour, what would we have seen? Have we got any idea?
Yes, we did. The harbour actually is one of the best excavated bits. It was a huge circular harbour with a series of ship sheds that go down to them, that come down on all sides and off an island in the middle. So you can store a whole navy there and then launch it really quickly. And that was a spectacular structure. A lot of the land of Punic Carthage, there have been huge excavations. You go down through early Islamic levels and then through the late antique city, or on top of that, the city of the Vandals who took control of Carthage.
Of course,
Carthage.
Yeah.
And so getting actually down to the second century BC is more difficult to tell. The Romans, when they did come, they restructured the city physically. They leveled the top of the hill and created a huge terrace for a great temple. So,
but do you think the buildings would have been made of wood rather than, because you talk in your book about the marbleization of cities, and that's something which happens much later. And yet, as you say, when we all imagine an ancient city, that's what you imagine is great big marble temples and that kind of thing. But this is that's not the kind of city that this edition of Carthage would have been, is it?
It may have been up to a point in the last generations, because in many ways Carthage is a Hellenistic city, but it's really just impossible to tell. Really, we know a bit about Hellenistic Alexandria and Athens and Antioch and so on, but what the Romans did first by destroying and then by building has more or less obliterated
the evidence.
The Punic city.
Hi, I'm Artemis. You'll know me as one of the presenters on this podcast. At Travels Through Time, we're incredibly proud to be partnering with Jordan Lloyd, one of the world's leading visual historians. His extraordinary photo colorization work has appeared on the covers of National Geographic, Life, and People magazines, and he's worked on special projects for titles like The Times of London and NPR. The quality of his work really has to be seen to be believed. Portraits of Charles Darwin and Abraham Lincoln, and sweeping panoramas of the D-Day beaches in June 1944, just to name a few. One of our favourites is a colourised shot of RMS Titanic as she cuts loose from her moorings in Southampton in 1912 to begin her fateful voyage. It's a picture full of narrative power. These images are now available as beautiful prints, and they make an unusual and striking present for that friend or family member of yours who loves the past. To find your favourite historical image, have a look at Jordan's site at www.colorgraph.co. And that's colour spelt the American way, C-O-L-O-R, colorgraph.co.
Brilliant. Okay, well, so that's our first port of call, as it were, Carthage, which has been destroyed. And the next scene that you're going to take us to is a city on mainland Greece, quite near to Athens, called Corinth. So if you could take us there, tell us what kind of a city it was and why it's important at this moment.
Yeah, well, Corinth is one of the most ancient cities of the Greek world. There are many myths around it. There's an ancient fountain, the Fountain of Pirene, in the middle. It's sitting right at the southern end of the isthmus that connects southern Greece to central Greece. And so it has two harbours, one leading out to the Aegean, one out to the Adriatic through the Saronic Gulf and the Gulf of Corinth. There was a dragway across the isthmus of Corinth, which allowed you to bring a boat up to one side and then literally drag it across land. Now there's the Corinth Ship Canal, but in the ancient world it was a dragway called the Diolkos. There were famous games there called the Isthmian Games for the isthmus. So it's one of the great old cities, and because of its sort of strategic position at the bottom of the isthmus, connecting to two seas, with a very high citadel above it called the Acrocorinth, like the Acropolis, but with Corinth on the end. It came to be known as one of the fetters of Greece, one of the pinch points that if you controlled it, you could control movement through Greece. So it's ancient, cultural, religious, strategic value, and quite a big city as well.
So the Romans obviously realised that Corinth is a place that they've got to conquer as part of their expansion. Tell us the story. What happens?
Well, actually, for a while, the Romans, they were lucky to stay independent so long, I think. When Rome moves into across the Adriatic, sort of at the end of the war with Hannibal, it begins attacking the kingdom of Macedon, which occupies a huge chunk of what today would be northern Greece and some bits of the former Yugoslavia and adjacent countries, so huge territory, which had been the starting point for Alexander the Great. And in that period, Rome was looking for allies, and one of the groups of allies it found, people who were on the basis of my enemy's enemy is my friend, people who also weren't keen on the Macedonian kings, were the cities of southern Greece, and Corinth was a leading one of them. So to begin with, the The cities of that era, they created something called the Achaean League. The Achaean League were Roman allies, and for a long time they were the sort of people who Rome favoured when they've fallen out with other groups like the Aetolians or Rhodians or whoever. One of the earliest things the Romans do is they remove a Macedonian garrison from that Acrocorinth and free Corinth. So for a long time, two or three generations, Corinth is a privileged ally, but as Rome gets stronger and stronger, it takes less and less notice of what its allies say. The allies don't feel they're being respected. And during what's happening in Carthage, the Greeks are watching this very nervously. There's good connections. Polybius said that while he was at Carthage during the siege, he was watching the tensions arise and trying to calm things down through diplomatic connections. He failed. And the Greeks of southern Greece, the Achaean League, decided that they would make a stand, and a man named Critolaus summoned detachments from all the cities to come and meet him at Corinth, because this was the great defendable point. And the Romans, who probably hadn't really wanted to have two big wars on at the same time, eventually found themselves coming south out of Macedonia, where their province was, and marching down across the isthmus, taking the city of Corinth and making an example of it, probably originally just to stop revolt spreading more widely.
To the other cities. Do you think there was an awareness in Greece at that time, as there was with the Romans, with Scipio, do you think there was an awareness that they were on the wane, that their star was no longer in the ascendant or not?
I don't know. It's difficult to tell. I mean, the period of Greece that we often read a lot about when we study history is a period where the Greek cities were all independent.
When you talk about Greece, and you have this idea that it's a sort of homogenized place or entity, and it really was, it never was it? It was always a collection of colonies. Of course, you have Athens and cities like Corinth and Sparta, which are sort of on mainland Greece and perhaps at the heart of it. You know, there were all those Greek cities, and certainly when it comes to the intellectual world, places like Pergamon and Ephesus and those kind of high places of Greek culture, Alexandria as well, they weren't in Greece. They were sort of Greek.
No, they were maybe around 1,000 separate cities, all of them fiercely independent or trying to be. But in reality, even from the 4th century, a lot of them had to kowtow to neighbouring powers. First of all, it's the Persian Empire, which controlled a lot of the cities of Asia Minor through the 5th and 4th centuries. Then the Kingdom of Macedon, when that becomes powerful. For a lot of the period before the Romans get involved, you find cities in Greece playing off the Macedonian kings of Egypt against the Macedonian kings of Macedon. Athens for a while gets sort of competitive benefactions from all these great kings, from the kings of the Attalids of Pergamon.
Yes,
Assyrian
I remember
kings.
That. Yeah. So what happens next? Do the Romans, they take Corinth over? They stay? Do they destroy it? Do they stay there? Do they set up their own garrison? How does it work?
Well, they do garrison it, and they do a lot of damage, and they destroy temples and buildings, and the stories about huge amounts of booty taken. In fact, we know that the general Mummius, who did this, brought back a lot of booty and set it up in monuments around Italy, not just in Rome, but in other towns. And they stripped treasure out, and Corinthian vases, Corinthian metalwork, and particularly paintings. And one scene that is described again by Polybius of watching Roman soldiers actually using old paintings, Greek paintings, as boards on which to play games, to play dice, to play drafts. And they trashed the place. And even there's a story that one Roman soldier who's caught doing this is told by his commander, if you take care of those old masters, if you break them, you have to provide new ones.
Doesn't help the whole image of the Roman Empire as uncultured, and in comparison to the Greeks, that must have been a contributory factor.
All of these stories are told in Greek sources.
Yeah, of course. Well, certainly when it comes to things like, mathematics and those really academic kind of subjects, there's a lot of great quotes from, Greek academics under Roman rule, and especially Galen had a particularly withering attitude towards Roman intellectual culture.
Didn't he?
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting, though. I think it's strange. Why didn't they? Because the Romans were so incredible when it came to building roads and logistics and military matters and technology, aqueducts. And it seems strange that they didn't take on the sort of more pure forms of maths and science. I don't know. It's a mystery.
I think sometimes they just regarded this as something you had people do for you. You know, that
you had your Greeks to do it for you.
Yes, Greek mathematicians, Greek doctors. Yes, yeah. Greek slaves to educate your children. Yeah.
So now they've got Corinth. Do they then move on to Athens and Sparta and the other neighbouring cities, or do they just sort of stay?
Not immediately. I mean, for a while, what they do is they control Greece, southern Greece, sort of remotely from their province of Macedonia. So the governor of Macedonia sends troops. It still treats most of these cities as independent, but gives them orders. And there are Roman garrisons where they're needed. There's an attempt to create a post-war settlement. Of course, Polybius, others are brought in to try and sort things out among the cities. But it doesn't really become southern Greece hasn't really got very much strategic importance, and for wider goals, and Rome's more interested in the really big powers, and in this period, it's not really trying to create a permanent territorial empire; it's just trying to be the leader. And as long as people follow their commands, they're often allowed to do things locally. So there would be some people in the Greek world for whom things wouldn't have changed very much. But every time a big decision had to be made, they had to look to Rome. And if they made a decision that Rome didn't like, it would just be overturned immediately.
And that must have been frustrating, certainly for the ruling classes of these Greek cities, I can imagine.
I think it must have been, although probably just like in the 5th century, every city had a pro-Spartan and a pro-Athenian faction who were fighting out among themselves. So in these Greek cities, a lot of them had a pro-Roman faction and a pro-Syrian faction or something else. And we see this again and again in history of city-states, don't we? Think about Renaissance or late medieval Italy, the Guelphs and the Ghibelline factions every city.
One of the most confusing moments in history, if you ask me. I've never got a handle on
it. Well, if you're confused, I'm doubly confused. It really is your period, not mine.
Well, exactly. Okay, so now we're going to move on to my favourite city of the ancient world, Alexandria, which is, of course, in modern-day Egypt. And it was the greatest intellectual city in the entire ancient world. I think no one would
That's
argue
right,
with that.
Yeah.
It's not yet under Roman control, but the Romans must have had their eye on Alexandria for a while, I would imagine.
Yes, they must have done. I mean, the very earliest traces, it's difficult to be sure, but Alexandria's amazingly cosmopolitan. Every language you can imagine was spoken there. Our longest text in Etruscan comes from Egypt. So all sorts of connections with the West. It had been one of those cities created after Alexander the Great's death, soon afterwards. And at some point, there is this creation of a Temple of the Muses, and the original museum, first museum, and associated with this, a library, the first monarchically sponsored library in the Mediterranean. There'd be much earlier ones in Babylonia and Nineveh. The Assyrians in particular loved creating libraries, but the first great collection of works in Greek was created by the kings. The kings of them are virtually all called Ptolemy, which is particularly confusing. And their queens are virtually all called, after a while, Cleopatra. So we come in at this point with Ptolemy the 8th and Ptolemy the 6th and Cleopatra the 2nd. So quite a lot of Ptolemies have gone downstream already by this point.
Do the Cleopatras get to rule in their own right? Because definitely the last Cleopatra, was she not almost the last of that dynasty to rule?
That's right, she's the last of that dynasty, and she probably is the only Cleopatra to rule in her own right. Also, allegedly, the first of that dynasty to learn Egyptian. But in the beginning of the 2nd century, so in the run-up to, the same time where Greece is learning to get to grips with Rome dominating Macedon, and the Carthaginians are trying to live it out as a second-rate power, having been a first great power. At this time, there are three kings ruling in Egypt. There's Ptolemy the VIII, Ptolemy the VI, and Cleopatra the II. That's two brothers and a sister. And they rule right up to 164. And they squabble terribly. And so
do they rule together, or are they? And why, can you explain the discrepancy in the Ptolemies' numbers? Because that seems quite strange.
It's even stranger. Ptolemy the VII may never have existed. So it's a combination of sort of scholarly confusion. At the time, of course, they gave them nicknames. Ptolemy, Ptolemy Philometer.
Ptolemy Soter.
That's right, yes. Yeah. So the numbers are modern, and of course we got it slightly wrong. And when you get people who are kings and then get thrown out and then come back and be kings, yeah, do you count them by their first reign or their second reign?
I see. So Alexandria is not in a good state. It's not sort of stable, successful state.
It's not at all. It sort of reached its great age. Was actually the same as the time when Hannibal was rummaging around Italy under Ptolemy the IV. And that's the period where Alexandria is really the most monumentally splendid. They build a great tomb for Alexander the Great as well. And then there are rebellions and there are struggles with neighbouring powers. And unfortunately, these struggles included within the royal family. And at one point, one of the Ptolemies, Ptolemy the VI, runs off to Rome, and Rome has to reinstate him. And so we get the feeling that from then on, what matters is which member of the royal family has got Rome on their side. Rome brokers pieces, and at one point, one of the Ptolemies goes off and becomes king of Cyrene, and he's king of Cyrene in 145, and his brother and his sister are ruling Egypt, and then the brother who's ruling Egypt dies, and the Ptolemy who's ruling Cyrene comes back in, and this starts a period of complete chaos. There's supposedly a persecution of the scholars in the museum, and there are people fleeing from Alexandria. The internal rebellions don't really settle down, and so from this point, this city, which, as you said, it culturally, architecturally, probably in terms of population, it's easily the rival of Rome. But whereas Rome is really focused and has this sort of huge outward urge, this, you know, run not by a monarchy yet, but by aristocrats who are competing, firstly, to get great commands and win booty, but secondly, to demonstrate their virtue to the people who elect them to offices. So Rome is on the rise. And Alexandria, it's chaotic. It's you know, what was once the major power in the Eastern Mediterranean is turned in on itself.
Yeah, and so the Romans don't come and attack Alexandria at this time. That happens later, doesn't it? So Alexandria is sort of allowed to continue, but with Rome keeping an eye on it during this period.
Rome does intense diplomacy. Kings of Egypt struggle to keep Romans on side. Occasionally, there's Roman ambassadors are sent in. They've been doing this in the East for quite a long time. They did it to a king of Syria who invaded Egypt a little before this period. And the king of Syria, Antiochus IV, is marching with his army on the borders of Egypt. He's about to invade Egypt. And a Roman envoy meets him from the Senate. And he says, Rome says, go back. And the king says, well, yeah. And then the envoy, the story goes, takes a stick and he draws a circle in the sand around the king's feet and says, give me your answer to the Senate before you step out of that circle.
Wow.
So that's the original line in the sand. That's where the figure comes from. You draw a line in the sand.
So they already have extraordinary power, even without having conquered everything. They already have this sort of, that, you know, it already is a sort of an enormously powerful entity, Rome, at this point.
It is. But it's a chaotic entity. What happens in 100 years on from 146, we've got Julius Caesar, and the whole Mediterranean is being reorganized into provinces, and after that, Augustus, and it becomes a properly organized empire, governors in all the provinces.
And isn't that when Alexandria is taken over, isn't it, Julius
Caesar?
That's
right.
Yeah.
Yes, it's the defeat of Antony. So it's when the young Octavian, who will become Emperor Augustus, is hunting down the people who were the enemies of his great uncle of Julius Caesar, and eventually end up hunting down one of Caesar's friends, Antony, his right-hand man. And Antony by this stage has teamed up with Cleopatra, and it's in chasing them back to Egypt that Egypt finally becomes formally under Roman control. But by that time, it's been pushed about by Rome for a century and a half already.
Something that I find very interesting is the whole idea of how developed were their hydraulics. And of course, you know, this may seem like quite a sort of mundane technical thing, but it's extremely important. You know, how does the infrastructure of the city work? How committed are these people to living in a community? You know, do they have a water supply? Have they dug wells that are used by everyone? I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about that in relation to these cities at this period. How developed was that kind of thing in 146 and 145?
It was very developed. I mean, you're right, of course, it happens in all ancient cities in Mesopotamia and the Valley of Mexico and so on. But if any number of people live together, they have to find ways to get water and to get rid of their waste. And in the Mediterranean, which has these arid, dry summers and not many great rivers, then you need to take special care of this. Alexandria is a bit luckier than most in that respect. But by 146... Rome has its first aqueduct built out of the sand. The Aqua Claudia is built out of the spoils of Carthage in 144, I think.
I will say it. So they used bits of stone that they'd...
They extracted money.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And then they, by emptying other people's treasuries, Rome often imposed war indemnities on its victims, forced them to pay so much silver or gold every year. And then this was then used to beautify the city.
But
the hydraulics, it's absolutely essential. That's why most Mediterranean cities are so tiny, because in an area where the soil's thin and the summers are dry and you quite often have bad harvests, small communities are much more resilient than big ones. They can manage, they can store enough food for a bad year, they're mostly living quite close to the land. There are not many idle hands to feed. If necessary, they can travel and they can bring stuff in. Now, emergency supplies for a city of 1,000 is a bit different from emergency supplies for a city of 1,000,000, which is what Rome becomes eventually. So the larger the city, the more infrastructure you need to build. There's harbours, granaries, making the connections to distant places a bit easier to manage.
Yeah. And then, of course, you get the development of public buildings, marketplaces, squares, gymnasia. And I thought that was interesting.
Great bathhouses.
Bathhouses, yeah, which were so important as a sort of mark of civilization.
Yeah. And once you've got peace, once you've got the Pax Romana, you can do things like supply yourself for a long way away. It isn't very safe to supply a city by aqueduct water if you might be besieged at any moment, because the enemy can always cut off the water supply.
Yeah, or poison it.
Roman Carthage has an amazingly long aqueduct feeding it from, you know, bringing water from, you know, miles and miles away. So does Pergamon, the city of Pergamon, the city of Rome, of course.
And another thing that I wanted to just touch on is when we talk about the remains that are left, and there's a part of your book where you talk about the sort of cities being palimpsests and being able to kind of look, you mentioned it briefly earlier, looking down through the layers and being able to see the sort of traces. And I think you give an example of in London underneath the Guildhall.
Trace of the amphitheatre underneath there, yes.
Because I love that idea that, you know, you can walk around in our modern world and still be aware. And certainly Rome is probably the best example of that, where there's just literally bits lying around. It seems that everywhere you look, there's a crumbled temple or a...
That's wonderful, isn't it? You walk through the Centro Storico and you go from a, you know, medieval square into a Baroque church, and then suddenly there's a bit of a Roman temple sticking out of a wall.
Yeah, and it seems like they have so much they can't... I mean, in England, everything is, you know, very much English heritage has been there and put a nice thing round and a plaque, and you can't... But in Rome, it just seems there's just so much they can't control it all. It's just lying around wherever you look.
I think London, in a way, starting a bit later, but there are bits of London you can walk through and you pass from one period to another in a few metres. But I know what you mean about Rome. And
are there any places that you went to research this book that particularly, you know, struck you, that perhaps somewhere you hadn't been before?
The places I've been before, I wrote a certain amount of it in Rome and a certain amount in Madrid, so they were interesting places to explore. One of the things quite interesting was to see cities where bits of the past have been more or less completely removed. And One of the things exciting if you go to Madrid now is that there's a big interest in the Islamic city, which for many years was sort of hardly talked about. It wasn't very important. People were interested in the Christian origins, the royal period. But now people think, well, actually, yeah, we've got an Islamic past as well. Athens is also an interesting city from that point of view, because in that case, we go to see the curated buildings of classical Greece with some Roman ones attached, like the great Herodes Atticus Odeon. But what you can't see anymore are the minarets that used to cover the city. Mary Beard, in her book about the Parthenon, pointed out that Parthenon had been used as a Christian place of worship and a Muslim place of worship for quite a bit longer than it was ever used for worshipping Athena.
Yes, so, but that again is that thing of having the full scope of history, isn't it? And sort of, I found that when I went to the cathedral in Syracuse, and it was, that was actually the starting point for my research, because, you know, I went, you go into that church, and it does look very much like a church, but there are the columns that have been incorporated into the walls, which were part of the Greek temple that was built there, you know, 2,500 years earlier.
Oh, wonderful. Syracuse is still on my bucket list. That sounds fantastic.
Have you not been there?
No, I haven't.
Oh, you have to go. It is, of all the places I've been, it is the place where you feel like the history is closest. It feels like the curtain is, you can really look through. It's such a magical place. So I just have one last question, which I don't think I warned you about, but I'm sure it's not going to be a problem for you. The last question we always ask is, if you could choose one item from any of the places that you've taken us, what would it be? If something, one thing you could bring back with you to the present day, what would it be?
I think one of the things that we have nothing of from the ancient world are its paintings. They once had a whole set of great artists and paintings which were famous and talked about by Pliny the Elder and so on. And they've all disappeared. All we have are sort of images of paintings on the walls of Pompeian houses and accounts of them. But we have no old masters at all. They've all just disappeared. So if I could go back to those soldiers who are playing games on the martyrs, and if I could persuade them to give me Aristides' picture of Dionysus or one of those other great famous masters talked about, then that would be a wonderful thing to bring back.
That would be wonderful, because I think also what we lack is the colour. I mean, even a lot of those statues would have been painted, but yet much your image of ancient Greek art is cool white marble sculptures and columns. But I think possibly even a lot of the buildings would have been painted as well, wouldn't they? Like medieval churches were before the Reformation. So it's almost like we see that world in black and white. I think that's a really good choice. Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you. It's been a real joy to be able to talk to you properly.
And well, I've enjoyed it too. Thank you for inviting me on.
Thank you very much indeed.
That was Violet Moller talking to Professor Greg Wolfe about some of the vivid stories contained in his latest book. The Life and Death of Ancient Cities is recently published in hardback by Oxford University Press. It's striking to think how small those cities were, the equivalent in population terms, really, of just a handful of London streets around where I'm sitting right now. Head to TTT Podcast for more about Wolfe's book, about the scene he describes. And if you want to follow along in real time, then you can get news about upcoming episodes and things like that on our Twitter feed at @TTTPodcast_. If you haven't already noticed, we published two episodes today. The other is with the journalist and humorist Craig Brown. He takes Artemis off to see the world's biggest band, a presidential assassination, and a train robbery in the 1960s. Can you guess the year? I bet you can. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with more next Tuesday. Thank you very much. Goodbye.